This is Bart Peterson, and you are listening to the FCPA Compliance Report on the Compliance Podcast Network.
This is Greg Gilchrist, and you are listening to the FCPA Compliance Report on the Compliance Podcast Network.
This is Dan DeMarco, and you are listening to the FCPA Compliance Report on the Compliance Podcast Network.
This episode, I have back fan favorite Mike DeBernardis. We take a look at Q3 in the FCPA world. It certainly started off with a bang with Novartis and never slowed down. We take a look at some U.S. domestic corruption issues. We consider the Herbalife FCPA enforcement action and the Sargent Marine enforcement action. We take a look at the FCPA Resources Guide, second edition. We look into where the DOJ and SEC might be going. Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, back for another episode. Today, I have back with me Mike DeBernardis, counsel at Hughes Hubbard. And we're going to take a look at Q3 of the year in FCPA. Mike, first of all, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Happy to be back and happy to talk about what was a very fast-paced Q3.
So as I tried to think through what we might entitle this episode, I just finally came down that it was a hell of a quarter. And it started off with a bang on July 1, and it never slowed down. And really, Mike, the first thing I wanted to focus in or at least visit with you on is Novartis. At the end, the last week of June, Novartis announced, or the DOJ announced, an FCPA settlement with Novartis. And then the first week of July, the Department of Justice announced a FCA, Federal Claims Act, settlement with Novartis. It was basically the same conduct outside and inside the United States. The FCPA part was a $265 million fine, and the FCA inside the United States part was, I think, $735 million anyway, over a billion total. And so many compliance practitioners don't often think about domestic corruption, and senior management never thinks about domestic corruption. And I was just wondering, is that now a discussion we can or even need to have?
Yes. I mean, I think if it was just Novartis, it would be one thing. But you have Novartis sort of in a close time with a few other domestic corruption settlements. You had ComEdison in Illinois, First Energy in Ohio, and then just in September, we had Quantadyne, the defense contractor, in Virginia. And when you put all of those together, it really is a sharp reminder that low risk does not mean no risk. I think that's a really key takeaway. And this is a challenge, right? I mean, you have guidance from every regulator around the world saying you should have a risk-based compliance program. And a lot of companies take that to mean we're going to devote our compliance resources to the territories and activities that have the highest risks and leave the lower risk areas alone. And this is really, it really is a reminder that you can't just leave them alone, that some compliance controls need to be in place in those spots. And you know, whether it's you know, paying attention when you have an important piece of legislation coming down, as was the case with First Energy and Commonwealth Edison, or when there's an important tender going out, like was the case with Quantadyne, you have to have some sort of controls in place, some effort to check and monitor these activities. Or you know, the consequences can be significant. One of the big takeaways, as you touched on with Novartis, is we have this interesting juxtaposition, right, with the FCPA, and then the U.S. conduct, and the U.S. conduct was ended up being twice as harsh in terms of a penalty. So hard to say, based on that activity in the U.S. is no risk.
And then the other thing that I would only add to our list of cases, Mike, is that with the increase number of government contractors, if you do work for the U.S. federal government, you have to have a compliance program. and many longtime government contractors, and you name the industry, they understand that. But the new ones, they may not fully appreciate how robust their compliance program needs to be. And as the federal government expands out its assistance and resources during the coronavirus health crisis, I think many companies now are going to find themselves under scrutinies in ways they have not, because they felt they were private, they were not international. They, as you said, viewed themselves as low risk and did not really see the need to elevate compliance to the level that was warranted. And so I think now we're going to have a much more robust scrutiny by the federal government inside the United States around compliance programs as well.
It's an excellent point. I think you're absolutely right. With the CARES Act stimulus, you have a lot of money up for grabs, and a lot of companies and new entities and new players getting involved for the first time and taking federal money or being involved with federal money. And there are expectations that come with that, that a lot of companies, I think, are not prepared for. And if we have another round of stimulus, post-election, there's even more opportunity for this.
So next, I'd like to turn, if we can, to the Herbalife FCPA settlement. And what struck me there, Mike, was I saw some really superior lawyering, as we say in Texas. What I really wanted to use this case, though, is to ask you, if you find yourself with a serious FCPA problem, I've always advocated you need serious response. And I don't mean go out and do a serious investigation. I mean hire some seriously good counsel. And I know that's your business, and I know that's what you do. But is that a message that you feel, one, is valid, and two, really resonates?
Yeah, you're giving me a really big opening here to sell. I'll try not to do that too much. Look, there's a lot at stake in these cases. So, and anytime you have numbers and potential penalties the size that we're dealing with here, every incremental advantage you can get can be hugely important. Herbalife, they had some of the premier practitioners in this area as counsel, which I think it does come through. I think you're correct. I think there is something very important to having counsel that goes in discussions with regulators that is credible, has a reputation, because you need that that credibility when dealing with the regulators. You also, can't forget that although most of these cases, all of the cases with companies end up settling, that doesn't mean there's no room for advocacy. And so you have to have counsel that has the ability to advocate for clients and knows when to exercise that advocacy. And then, finally, I think one of the overlooked aspects is finding counsel, and the good ones do this, that are really a good fit and can have the really difficult conversations with the board and the C-suite, because a lot of the decisions that have to happen to help you get the best resolution possible are really tough decisions. We're talking about, terminating employees. You're talking about offering extreme cooperation to the government, and that's not always a natural thing, particularly for people not practiced in this area. And if there's hesitation or a disconnect between the outside counsel and those individuals making the decision, you'll see it on the back end. You'll see it in these settlements, and it's easy to put the numbers on it, but there's a big difference between getting a 25% reduction off the bottom of the sentencing guidelines and getting a 15% reduction when we're talking the numbers we are. And so a big part of that is that those important communications between the lawyers, internal lawyers, external lawyers, and the decision makers, and doing, having those decisions made quickly, because a delay can really cost you.
Mike, the most interesting thing I found about your comments were, you did not talk about any of the technical skills or capabilities we normally associate with lawyers, being able to do an investigation, being able to interpret the law and explain it. You talked about advocacy. You talked about having difficult conversations with clients, and you talked about credibility. And those, to my mind, really are what separates the top white collar compliance practitioners from others. But let me focus just a minute, because I was really intrigued by advocacy. I rarely hear that talked about in FCPA or white collar defense, but the ability to not simply marshal facts, but put together a coherent story for the regulators. I guess what you're saying is the regulators listen.
I mean, they're going to have their own opinions and views, a good legal team can go in and make a really persuasive case, particularly if you're starting with credibility, and then you're moving in and you're not arguing just for argument's sake, but making really accurate and measured points on behalf of your client. And look, often it's around the margins. It's about, well, this particular activity was outside the statute of limitations, or, you know, this activity based on these facts, we don't think would qualify as a violation. It's not just a black and white violation, no violation. But each of those things can add up and really affect the conduct that's captured in a settlement and the total amounts involved. And I think you're absolutely right. You can ask a third year law student to break down the basics of an FCPA case, an FCPA violation. It is where you really separate the very good and experienced counsel is in these other areas, these more nuanced areas.
Literally on the second day of the quarter, July 2nd, the Department of Justice and the Securities and Exchange Commission very quietly released the second edition to the FCPA Resources Guide. It was originally delivered in 2012, and so it was really due for an update, given nearly 8 years since its original release. We were able to visit about this a little bit in a prior podcast, so I didn't want to spend a lot of time, but I was wondering if there may be two or three kind of key points you've taken away from it and that you've really used with discussions with clients.
Sure. They released it at an interesting time, right? July 2nd, right before the July 4th holiday, almost like they were just trying to slide it in unnoticed. But, the one thing that I think we were anticipating here when this came out was how are they going to handle some of the precedent that's come out now interpreting the FCPA and really thinking a lot about the Hoskins case and how the jurisdictional piece was going to work. And so just anticipating what they were going to do there. And so we obviously took note of the fact that the DOJ and SEC are really sticking to their guns when it comes to their jurisdictional reach and really tried to carve out the decision in Hoskins related to foreign non-issuers and whether those individuals had to be an agent of an issuer or domestic concern to come under the FCPA. They really tried to carve that out and make that a Second Circuit anomaly. In conversations with clients, that have asked about this, a lot of what we see in the update is what you would expect after 8 years, just updates with more recent case studies, fixing some of the language and fine tuning. There are a couple of points that we do, I have certainly brought up with clients. One is there was a slight change in the discussion around successor liability. And this is always a question for clients when they're engaging in mergers and acquisitions. And so the key takeaway there, I think, is robust pre-acquisition due diligence is best, but there is an understanding that sometimes that's just not possible, or at least not as possible to be as robust as you would like it to be. In those instances where you cannot do robust pre-acquisition due diligence, the revised resource guide really focuses in on this idea of doing robust post-acquisition due diligence. And I think that's really important and something we've talked to clients about is even if you can't get everything done you wanted to before the acquisition, you should be okay as long as you can, and do make strong efforts post acquisition to dig in and make sure there's no problems there. And then the other point that we've been talking about with clients is the in the discussion of the hallmarks of an effective compliance program that was in the 2012 edition and is again in the 2020 resource guide. There appears to be a slightly more emphasis on the area of investigation and remediation as a key element of the compliance program itself, rather than separate from the compliance program. And I think this is important, particularly for companies that are just starting out with compliance. There's a tendency to view the need to do an investigation and to take remedial measures as a failure of the compliance program. And the resource guide makes it clear that it is the ability to do a proper investigation and take important remedial steps is a sign of a properly working compliance program. And so if you take that view, I think it allows companies to be a little more aggressive in their investigations and a little more, for lack of a better term, enthusiastic about doing those and taking appropriate remedial steps, because it's not sort of an acknowledgement that we have this serious failure.
Would it be fair to say, as listeners to podcasts with you and I, Mike, we try to review these on a quarterly basis. And in Q2, we talked about the 2020 update to the evaluation of corporate compliance programs. And for me, one of the key emphasis was continuous monitoring leading to continuous improvement. It almost seemed like to me that the FCPA Resource Guide second edition was putting investigations into that mechanism for continuous monitoring and continuous improvement. But I really like the way you have taken it. I think a next step that it can be used not as a way to simply monitor, but as a proactive step to show the efficacy of your compliance program. And if a weakness is discovered, then you can move forward to remediate. But it seems to me to be what the DOJ said to us in the 2020 update, that they want to see more movement towards monitoring and updating your program on a continuous basis.
Absolutely. I think it is part and parcel with that that guidance from June. And, you know, we talk about a compliance program that is designed to prevent, detect, and deter. And, you know, this idea of investigation and remediation really hits all three of those, because obviously in detecting misconduct, often are using investigations for that and deterring misconduct as well. And then, you know, in terms of preventing misconduct, it's important to take these lessons learned, right? And it's a constant, every time you do an investigation and you take remedial measures to fill gaps, it's a constant effort into improving that prevention piece of the compliance program.
Let me change the focus quite a bit now, because we had a very rare criminal FCPA plea by a corporation, and that was the Sergeant Marine case. Anyone who read that case pretty much came away with probably what I came away with, was this was a criminal enterprise wrapped around a business whose business strategy was based on bribery and corruption. But were there some takeaways that you felt were significant, or what were some of the key takeaways, I guess, from your perspective, Mike?
Sure. You know, the one that strikes me right off the bat is we have this discussion all the time about third parties and particularly consultants and agents, and our consultants and agents being the highest risk area when it comes to FCPA. And every once in a while, you have this gap of 6-7 months where there aren't any settlements involving, you know, strict use of consultants and agents. And then you have a case like this where it's just, you know, falls back to the tried and true method of engaging a consultant for the purpose of paying bribes. And I think when we start to get pushback from clients about whether this is still the highest risk area and what are the main risks, it's you know, selfishly, it from my perspective, it's nice to have another example to put in front of them to say, look, here's exactly why we're encouraging you to have robust due diligence in place. The other thing is, you know, this is somewhat a nuanced and small area, but you know, the penalty here, ultimately, I think they agreed to pay $16.5 million or something like that. But it was actually much larger penalty. Even with a 25% reduction off the bottom of the sentencing guideline range, I think the calculated penalty was $90 million. The $16.6 million came about after inability to pay analysis, a pretty robust one. And I think that's something that, you know, companies often forget about, and something that maybe I'm being too gracious, but something that you know, I think the Department of Justice should deserve a little bit of credit for doing and going through the effort to do, and showing that, you know, we're not trying to absolutely destroy these enterprises, even if they appear to be have major problems, and want to have a settlement that's fair and workable.
You know, Mike, that and you're absolutely right about that reduction, and kudos to the DOJ for good advocacy by their lawyers, as we talked about. But what that brought up for me was something a little bit different. And one of the major reasons the company was in such dire financial strait was that it couldn't continue to do business based on bribery and corruption. And they specifically called out the lack of contracts and financing that the company had anticipated receiving when they had a more robust cash flow, which they didn't have now. And it reminded me, years ago, I met someone who had worked at Panalpina during the day. And he said the biggest cost to Panalpina was not the fines and penalties. It wasn't even the reputational damage. It was they could not replace the business they lost because they only knew one way to do business in Africa. And the company never recovered from that. And this really seemed to me to be the situation for Sargent Marine. And we don't talk about very often that when a company is penalized for an FCPA violation, they can no longer do business in that manner. And you're going to lose some revenue stream, whether it's ongoing or if it was a one-time contract. So I thought that was an interesting point as well. But you're absolutely right on the inability to pay. And we didn't receive full information on the calculation the DOJ made, but they said they looked at it in a very robust manner. And even the trial judge who approved the criminal plea commented on it, on the DOJ's robustness on that. So if you find yourself in that sort of financial condition, it's certainly one tool you can at least consider.
That's right. And it's a great point too, Tom, about the Panalpina case. And, you know, for Sargent Marine, they were doing business with in some really tough environments. We were talking about in Venezuela with PDVSA, with Petrobras in Brazil, and Petroecuador. And, you know, you can certainly imagine the scenario where their business with those customers has been based entirely on these corrupt schemes. And when those corrupt schemes dried up, you know, their relationships dried up, they lost three incredibly lucrative customers.
Earlier in the first part of the quarter, we had a relatively small SEC FCPA enforcement action involving Alexion. And one of the things I've really come to appreciate, Mike, is these relatively small, once again, SEC enforcement actions, but they have a lot of detail in the cease and desist order and a lot of sort of into the weeds of what the compliance failures were and what a company needs to do. And I was wondering if I could maybe get your thoughts or takeaways from that case.
Absolutely. I agree with you. These smaller, and that term is obviously relevant. I mean, relative, right? That's what might be small to one is not so small to others. But these books and records SEC cases, they do have some really interesting detail, and especially because they make an effort to talk about the control failures as that's what they're charging them with. For Alexion, I think one of the key takeaways for me is it highlights the importance of having a strong internal audit function that can work sort of in collaboration and cooperation with a compliance program, because a lot of the failures here and that were described in that case are things that could and should have been pretty easily identified through a normal internal audit. We're talking about, you know, reimbursement of expenses without any underlying documentation, and paying invoices from consultants that are one word invoices. Things that if you have an internal audit that's working sort of in collaboration with a compliance department, you could really do a good job of identifying quickly and ending the practice. And you know, in this case, it instead of that, the conduct went on for 5 years before it was halted.
This year has been the largest amount total FCPA settlements ever. We of course had the largest international anti-corruption settlement ever with Airbus. We're having these massive cases. I think that may have surprised people that we would continue to see this. Others perhaps less surprised. But we seem to be in an era of continued, at least aggressive FCPA enforcement. You and your colleagues are a lot closer to the front lines of this. Do you still see this sort of aggressiveness, both from the massive cases down to the much smaller cases as well?
I think we anticipate steady activity. A lot of the I try not to draw too many conclusions from sort of the timing of these settlements and the fact that, you know, we had this massive case of Airbus in the beginning of the year, and you know, just recently with Goldman is another just hugely important and huge in dollar figures settlements. But I think we certainly anticipate just continued steady stream of enforcement. And look, you know, when the new administration came in 2016, there was a lot of talk about whether the Trump administration might dial back FCPA enforcement. And there's rumors that there was an attempt to shrink the FCPA unit at one point. But the fact that this level of enforcement has continued through that administration, one that, you know, where the president was sort of openly an open opponent of the FCPA prior to taking office, I think that the fact that it's succeeded, if you will, through that administration, really is a as clear a sign as any that this is just going to continue as we move forward, whether it's through many smaller settlements or you know, some of these larger ones. I don't know, but continued enforcement is certainly on the menu.
Well, Mike, I hope we can come back after Q4 and maybe put a ribbon on the year. But as I started out this podcast, it was a hell of a quarter, and I'm even more convinced so after talking to you. So thanks again.
Thanks, Tom. It was fun.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox again. I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of the FCPA Compliance Report. If you have any questions on this episode, you can email me at tfox@tfoxlaw.com. I would greatly appreciate it if you would rate our podcast in iTunes, as would help us increase our rankings and expanding our listener base for the oldest podcast in compliance. If you have any questions you'd like explored on this podcast, please send them to me as well, or you can leave them on the Compliance Podcast Network. The FCPA Compliance Report is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network. I hope you'll join us again next week, where we take up another issue in FCPA and compliance. Thanks again for listening.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.